ECO, also known as the English Chamber Orchestra, was under the direction of Richard Barning. Well, this has been a nice day with you on these past 3 hours, and hope to see you again in 3 weeks. But tune in next week to hear either Jim Wiener or Valerie Jean, and they'll be with you on the next two successive Saturdays to bring you more glorious classical music. Thank you, and tune in again. This has been your host, David Brown, for WUSB Stony Brook 90.1 on your FM stereo dial.
Stardate November 11th. On today's date, 417 years ago, a bright new star burst into view in the constellation Cassiopeia. Its appearance was a shock to people who had watched the stars for a lifetime and seen them remain virtually unchanged. Back then, the prevailing idea was that Earth lay motionless in the center of the universe. All change was believed to take place in the earthly realm, while in the realm of the moon, sun, and stars, nothing ever changed. But on that fateful night in 1572, a young Danish astronomer named Tycho Brahe saw a new star and couldn't believe his own eyes. A change in the heavenly spheres shook Tycho's belief in his world. Tycho called the event a miracle, but he didn't stop there. He wanted to understand the new star. He measured angles between it and the other stars and found that it didn't move. He studied the star for 6 months until it faded from view, and by then he was convinced it was indeed an unprecedented change in the heavenly realm. Today, with our very different picture of the universe, we explain Tycho's star as a supernova, an explosion of a massive older star. But that understanding came hundreds of years later. Meanwhile, Tycho had found his niche in life. He left behind his life as an idle Danish nobleman and went on to become one of the greatest observational astronomers in history, who helped break the conceptual bonds of the enclosed medieval universe. This is Stardate, and we'd like to send you a copy of our Stardate magazine. To receive one, send your name and address and $1 to the University of Texas McDonald Observatory, Austin, Texas, zip 78712. For the McDonald Observatory, I'm Joel Block.
Deadest moment across the ocean. like to know. God only knows
side wall. Some hand in hand, and some gathered together in bands. The bleeding hearts of the archers, they there stand. And when they've given you their all, some stagger and fall. After all, it's not easy. Banging your heart against some mad buggy's wall.
And for those that have never heard that, that's selections from Pink Floyd's The Wall. Banging your heart against some mad bugger's wall. That's what it's all about, isn't it? And, of course, it's a completely different way of looking at a wall. I mean, the wall that Pink Floyd is talking about is sort of an inner wall that an individual builds to protect himself against the cruel outside world, which really can be pretty cruel sometimes. But in a sense, I suppose the wall that surrounded West Berlin was rather the same thing from the East German point of view. It's gone. I mean, what else can I say? It's something that I've been saying on this program now for quite a while that amazing things are going on, amazing things will be happening. But every week I come in here and it's like, it's more shocking each time. Each time something even more bizarre goes on. And I'm wondering, is it all some kind of a joke or something? I have a feeling it's a joke that everybody's pulling on Ronald Reagan, so that he'll go around thinking that that he actually accomplished something. And then we're all going to say, surprise, we're only kidding, and he's going to be, feeling really badly. But no, I don't think that's the case here. I think this is really, really happening. I think it's going to be the dawning of a new era. And apparently so does the New York Times. Today's editorial in the New York Times, the end of the war to end wars. And, for all intents and purposes, there has been a war. I mean, any situation where you need a wall to separate two countries, where people are willing to risk their lives to scale that wall, that's a war. That's a war in my eyes. Crowds of young Germans danced on top of the hated Berlin Wall Thursday night. They danced for joy. They danced for history. They danced because the tragic cycle of catastrophes that first convulsed Europe 75 years ago and embraced two world wars, a Holocaust and a Cold War, seems at long last to be nearing an end. November 11th, now named Veterans Day, is the day of the armistice that ended World War I. But that war to end wars was lost when the victors bungled the peace. They exacted heavy reparations from Germany, paving the way to chaos and the rise of National Socialism. The years between the two wars turned out to be merely a truce. Hitler in 1940 received the surrender of the French forces in the same railroad car in which Germany's delegates surrendered in 1918, and Europe was again plunged into strife. Some 20 million people died in World War I, perhaps 50 million in World War II. But even these two appalling acts of miscalculation and bloodletting did not bring Europe's torments to an end. The tragedy had a third act. The Cold War divided a Europe freed from Hitler's tyranny from a Europe bowed under Stalin's. The Berlin Wall, erected by Erich Honecker in 1961, stood as the foremost symbol of that division and the continent's continuing stasis. I never could say that properly. I'm sorry. The reveling crowds of Berliners mingling from east and west could scarcely believe that the hated wall had at last been breached. Those watching them around the world could only share their delight and their wonder at the meaning of it all. If the horrifying cycle that began in 1914 is at last completed, what new wheels have begun to turn? Instability in Eastern Europe has seldom brought good news, but this dissolution may lead to settlement. even if the settlement's shape remains unclear. Armistice is only the laying down of arms, not peace. And for as long as it has stood, the Berlin Wall has symbolized a Europe not at peace and a world polarized by Soviet-American rivalry. Mikhail Gorbachev has spoken of a European house. No one, not even he, can yet be sure how the rooms might fit together. Still, no house has a wall through its middle, and for the first time in a generation, neither does Europe. Obviously, you've seen the news. I mean, there's really no way you can avoid it, even though I know a lot of us try. This is one bit of news that I don't think anyone would want to miss. As I saw many newscasters saying on television, this is history in the making. This is one of the most historic moments ever. I mean, the Berlin Wall is, it's still there. It's still there, but it's meaningless. It's meaningless because the East German government now allows citizens to travel freely to West Germany directly without any kind of hassle like they had been going through for many years since 1961 when the wall was built. Now, we'll be taking phone calls at 632-6901. I'd like to talk to people about their impressions of this. If anyone has ever been there, I was just there this past summer, and I'm sure glad I went because I was able to see it the way it was, and I really want to go back again and see it the way it is now and the way it will be in the future. I have on the phone a friend of mine in West Berlin, Tobias Rabishan. Tobias, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Hello.
Okay, hi. Having trouble hearing me at all?
No, not at all.
Okay, great. Well, you're in West Berlin now, where I must salute you for actually staying up to talk with us, because it's 4 o'clock in the morning, your time. Actually, it's 4:24 in the morning, your time. What is going on? What has happened over the last 24 hours? Do you want to kind of sum it up for us?
Well, it's been a chaos, absolute chaos. You must imagine we had today 500,000 visitors, 500,000 East Germans coming over to us, and West Berlin has only 2 million inhabitants. So the city was overcrowded with East Germans, and we, the West Germans, are fearing now that we can't buy food any longer. Shops are open today, tonight, well, not now because it's 4 o'clock in the morning, but they will be open on Sundays, tomorrow morning, to give the East Germans a chance to buy West German goods. And, well, I hope they'll leave something for me, so I don't have to stand in the queue in West Germany.
Well, how much of a problem do you think that's going to be with all these people over there? Is there any kind of resentment forming towards the East Germans?
Not now. I don't know what will be going on next week, because this is weekend and the people don't have to work and they come over and want to see West Berlin and West Germany. I don't know what will be next week. It's absolutely overcrowded, and I think the West Berliners will, they will resent it, because if you want to go to work with the underground, with a U-Bahn underground, and it's overcrowded and you can't, you're waiting 1, 2 trains, 6, 10 trains, and you can't get on the train because it's overcrowded with these Germans, you're getting angry somehow. Now it's, we're all having a party here. It's a big party. I can't describe it. It's great. It's absolutely great.
Is it something that you expected ever to see?
No, not at all. I didn't believe it. I didn't realize it when I heard it. I heard it on the radio and I said, the wall is gone. And I said to my friend, hey, the wall is gone. And we said that, the wall is gone. And it took 2 hours or even more for us to realize what really happened. We didn't believe it, and the people in the East either, they didn't believe it too. They thought this must be an error. This is wrong.
Now, the first day when all these East Berliners started swarming, which I imagine was yesterday, What was the street scene like? I mean, Berlin is a very big city. Both Berlins are very big cities, and usually there are crowds of people on the shopping streets and just milling about. It's a very pleasant place. But what was it like with all these extra people all of a sudden? I understand 100,000 people went over the wall that first day.
Well, they had to. It was as it always was in the outer areas of West Berlin, because no one went there. Everybody went to the Kudamm. This is the boulevard of West Berlin, the main street. And no, they had no more cars on it. You couldn't walk. It was overcrowded, absolutely overcrowded. You couldn't walk because there were so many people there. And today the same. And tomorrow we'll have the same. Well, this day, today we'll have the same again, I think. And it's what's great is things have not changed for West Berliner. But what you can do, and a friend of mine did it, you can borrow an East German passport and change the borders without being controlled or have to pay the change. You have to pay 25 marks kind of entrance fee for East Germany as a West German or West Berliner. You can use any East German passport. You just have to show it and you're going through. No problem.
I was under the impression that they had suspended all of that, that any West German could go to East Germany without having to pay the 25 marks. I mean, that's not in fact the case?
No, that's not the case. It's too overcrowded. It's too chaotic, the situation. And you can do things you would never have imagined you can do.
Now, from what I've heard, a lot of the East Berliners that have come over the wall in the last couple of days are coming over just for a visit, and then they're going back. I believe of the 100,000, only 2,000 remained. Does that sound accurate to you?
Pardon?
Only about 2,000 of the 100,000 East Berliners remained in West Berlin. The rest went back. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's absolutely right. They all just want to have a look how it's like. And some of them even fear the West. They can't believe it that they can come over. That's the point, that's the historic situation. But they fear it. They are so unsure. It's strange. It's too strange for them. Too different. They want to go back because they feel safer at home.
That's certainly understandable. Have many West Berliners felt like going to East Berlin to see what that's like?
I think they sure be more visit to East Berlin in the next days and next weeks more than ever, because things have changed, and I live here now for 5 years, and I've been in East Berlin only a couple of times because I don't know anyone over there, and why should I be a tourist in my own town? But I'll go over in the next days and just to make a visit and look how it's like there.
Now, of the East Germans the East Berliners that are there now, where do you find that they tend to congregate, and what is it that they seem to be most interested in doing?
Well, now you can say by the clothes the people wear if someone is an East Berliner or a West Berliner, but they are so used to rules. You see an absolutely overcrowded street with cars, a traffic jam, and the traffic lights are red. You can walk over. That's no problem. And East Germans, they stand and wait for the traffic lights to turn green. West Germans would never care. And that's because they are so used to rules, to follow rules, any kind of rules.
Now, you told me once that it was possible to be able to distinguish someone who was from East Berlin simply by the way they spoke. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, of course they have a different accent. Somehow, it's a different accent. It's not the way they... Well, it's not the way so much in the way they speak, but the way they behave. It's like they're from a different culture. Well, they are Germans, but it's a different culture. They behave different, and I try to explain that with a traffic light example. The light is red, and they stand and wait. No matter if you can go safe, if you can cross the street safe or not. And find another example how they behave. I can't say that now. It's too hard. It's hard to describe because things are changing so fast now. What I said to you this summer when you were here, you can distinguish East and West Germans. It's changing, and I'm no longer sure if someone on the street is an Easterner or a Westerner. It's so hard to tell now.
Do you care to make any predictions now that everything is completely wild and crazy? What do you think is going to happen next?
I don't know. I think this will... the East German people will come over for the next, say, 2 weeks, more and more, till nearly everyone in the GDR has been in the West. And then it will somehow be normal. We'll very fast get used to the situation, and things will have to change in the GDR. What I think is this decision to tear down the wall is a decision to give the Communist Party in the GDR time for themselves to think on the things they have to change in their country, say, on the elections and so on. Or economic changes. The decision to tear down the wall, to let people travel free, gives them time. It gives them a lot of time because everyone in the East is happy now, and no one thinks on things now or, say, for the next 2 weeks, what will have to change in their own country. They're too busy to to travel and to test their new freedom.
What we're hearing over here in the States is that in East Germany that liberalizes, that introduces democratic reforms, would have no reason to exist. It would just might as well reunify with West Germany. Do you think it's possible for a more democratic East Germany to exist, and do you think reunification is inevitable?
Well, I think it is possible for a changed East Germany to exist because it will stay a socialistic state. I don't think it's... I don't think they will just have a capitalistic system in 2 years. That's impossible, and they won't do it. And no one here in Berlin wants that too, because this would mean a catastrophe for East Germany. It would have this would mean a situation like in Poland now. Because we have now in West Berlin all the poor the very, very poor Polish people going, because their economy is down, absolutely down. So, and East Germany will exist longer as a state, of course. And, if they decide to have a capitalistic system, then reunion may be a thing to discuss then, because this would mean no differences. They could have the West German currency and so on, and reunited economy would mean we'll have East Germany, the GDR, superfluous.
Now, you live in what is probably the most unusual city in the world because of the wall, because of the fact that many people don't know that Berlin is in the middle of East Germany. It's not on the border of East and West Germany. Can you perhaps, for our listeners, just explain a little bit what it's like to live in such a strange place, like some of the things we might take for granted that people in the United States might not know about living in West Berlin?
it's hard, because what I take for granted is I live here and I don't worry about it. If I wanted to travel outside West Berlin, I'll say have a long walk in the woods. We have woods and very big parks inside West Berlin, but to go to West Germany, it's a drive off with a car, say, three hours drive. Well, that's because of the island situation.
So, I'm sorry, in effect, you live on an island. You have to drive 3 hours to get from West Berlin to another part of West Germany. You have to drive through East Germany to get there.
Yes. Yes, of course. That's it. We're used to that. And it's minimum 3 hours. That's the shortest way.
Now, the wall itself isn't actually dividing West Berlin from East Berlin so much as it's surrounding West Berlin. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's the wall, as you know it, it's the division of, say, the inner city, the old inner city of Berlin. But it's surrounding, yes, that's true, it's surrounding West Berlin, wholly.
Now, the scenes that we've been seeing here on American TV, lots and lots of people jumping and dancing on the wall, just how big is that? Because we're seeing the Brandenburg Gate, but, I mean, does that extend all the way to Checkpoint Charlie? Does it extend all the way around to the other part of the wall?
The Brandenburg Gate? No, you mean the dancing on the wall?
Right.
No, this is only at the Brandenburg Gate. It happened there because the Brandenburg Gate is kind of a symbol for the wall itself, for the partition of East and West.
But could you perhaps explain why that is? Because we might not be familiar with that here.
Well, I can't explain it too. It's maybe because this is the Brandenburg Gate, I don't know. It's a symbol, somehow.
It's the gateway to Berlin, right?
No, it's the Brandenburg Gate. It's on the east-west axis, so the big road, a very big road, an east-west axis going through Berlin. West Berlin to East Berlin. This is divided at the Brandenburg Gate, these axes. But there's no specific historic reason to it, for the Brandenburg Gate to be the symbol of the German division.
It's interesting too, because it's such a magnificent structure, but nobody can go near it except the guards. You know, I've always wanted to just sort of walk around and see it, but you know, you can't get there from East Germany and you can't get there from West Germany. It's not a crossing point. Well, at least it wasn't until now.
And it will not be a crossing point. They're opening a new crossing point near the Brandenburg Gate, say 500 meters south of the Brandenburg Gate. The wall has been tearing down. I haven't seen it, and I think it must be open now. By now or in a few hours, but people did cross, did walk through the Brandenburg Gate last night. I talked to a guy, a friend of mine, who did this. They just sprang down the wall, ran through the guards, and. This is because of the chaotic situation. As I said before, you can do things you would have never imagined you can do, like have a walk through the Brandenburg Gate. But this is only a few people could do this in a certain situation. Say, well, 20. No more.
I see. Now, I don't want to keep you on too much longer because it's almost 5 o'clock for you, but... when I was over there, as you know, I was fascinated by the subway system and the fact that certain lines ran underneath East Berlin but never stopped there. They would pass by abandoned stations and emerge back in West Berlin without ever stopping. And the East Berlin subway system is completely separated from the West Berlin system. Now that all this has become a bit more open, do you think they're going to merge the two systems again or anything?
They will. They're working on that. Already. They're opening, they have to because of the, of all the people who want to come over there. They opened, one of the abandoned stations as a crossing point. And, well, they can't do it in a few hours. They can't, match the two underground systems, in a few hours. But they will, I think, what will happen next is the opening of the abandoned stations and the opening of crossing points at the abandoned stations.
So do you think all the abandoned stations will be open now?
No, not all, a few of them. If you say, I think it's a dozen or, well, it's a dozen stations. Were abandoned, and well, say four of them will be open as crossing points. They're opening crossing points after crossing points. Yesterday they told they'll open four more, and now it's 10 more, and it's getting every day more.
Incredible. Do you think there's anything that that you can do or that we can do to encourage such positive things to continue? Is there anything maybe we shouldn't do?
It's hard to say. At the moment, I can't say it at the moment, what you shouldn't do. Well, you shouldn't fall back into Cold War thinking, but that's over anyway, I hope. You shouldn't think that because the wall is down, that the communist state and socialist states in the East are disappearing. They will change, and they have good reasons for change, but I think the GDR will stay, and it will stay a socialistic state, but with a human face.
So do you think it would be wrong to look upon this as a West over East victory of any sort?
Yeah, I think that's wrong. It's their decision, and it's homemade.
I see. I don't think I asked you this before. It's rather a simple question, and feel free to say you don't know. Why did this happen? Any ideas?
What do you mean? The changes in DDR,
well,
as a whole, or...?
I guess I do. The, not just the wall, but the overall changes. What was it that did it?
What was it that did it? It's... Ha! The all the people leaving the GDR, that gave them the pressure. You must imagine your bureau or your factory has to close because all the people left the state, and this happened because. Well, somehow it's a Westover-East victory, somehow. Because, and this happened because the West bought Hungary. Well, they gave them enough money. They bought them to, they gave them money and Hungary gave the East Germans the chance to leave the. To leave Hungary to West Germany.
Now that's
done with money.
That's very interesting the way you phrase that. We've been hearing Hungary has opted for democracy. You said that the West has bought Hungary. Is that the overall feeling there?
Well, not the overall feeling, but if you're reading the papers carefully, you'll get that information. No one is thinking now how all this happened, and because things are changing so fast and anything every day is new, every day has new news. But I think a lot of people think like that the West has bought Hungary.
Tobias, one final question, and I'll let you go. Now, you work for a radio station over there. It's rather similar to the one I'm on now, kind of a free-form station. But what's unusual about it is the fact that you have listeners both in West Berlin and in East Berlin. Now, the events of the last few weeks, how has that been reflected in the radio station, and how has it changed the radio station in any way?
No, it hasn't changed in the radio station. It's still a radio in West Berlin, and radio waves cross all walls. And that's it. What happened is that we had a lot of visitors these days, visitors from East Berlin, and they just want to have a look at the radio they have been listening to for the last years. That was funny, and that was very interesting, because we had very little feedback from people in East Berlin, less than from the listeners in West Berlin. And so we have a much better connection to our listeners in East Berlin.
I see. Well, it's been very enlightening talking with you, and it's certainly been inspiring to watch the events that have been happening in Berlin over the last few days, and in fact, over the last few weeks. Any final words from you?
No. I can't say anything to it. It's great, and I'll see on Monday what's going on next, and. This weekend is party for us now. It's a big party, and that's it.
That's great. And West Berlin in itself has always been a big party city, as I've experienced firsthand. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. You must be very tired. It's just about 5 o'clock in the morning where you are. You might as well get some sleep and keep us updated if anything anything new happens over there.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, and hopefully I'll see you again soon. I do want to go back there. I want to see what things are like again.
Come over. You're welcome.
Okay, say hi to everybody over there for me.
I'd say that.
Okay, good night, good morning, whatever.
Yep, bye.
And we were speaking with Tobias Robichon in West Berlin. Live phone call to West Berlin. And one of the people I met when I was over there this summer, and boy, was I glad to have gone to both Berlins. West Berlin, you know, as soon as I got off the train, and by the way, we will be taking phone calls. I know some people were calling in and they must have given up in frustration. Well, we'll be taking phone calls again, so call us 632-6901, area code 516. If you get a busy signal, just try again. 632-6901. Getting off the train after having traveled through East Germany for 3 hours or so, and as Tobias told us, you have to travel through East Germany to get to West Berlin for about 3 hours, both by car and by train. It's a very bizarre situation. If you're on the highway, you can't get off the highway, because if you get off the highway, you're in a foreign country, but obviously you're not going to get off the train. It's very strange. But getting off the train, it just seemed like such an alive kind of place, sort of like New York, very much like New York, except for one thing: the streets are incredibly big, and you know, about maybe three lanes of traffic in each direction, and they're all two-way streets, and the buildings are just huge, big buildings, you know, townhouses, whatever you want to call them, old too, a lot of history in that town. But a lot of young people staying out to all hours of the night, a lot of lights, things like that. But in addition to all of this liveliness, you have the mystique of the wall and what lies beyond the wall. And that fascinated me from the very first day I was there. And I ended up spending about 8 or 9 days in both Berlins. And the day that I actually went over to East Berlin was, it was pretty frightening, because I had never been there. I didn't know very many people who were there, and I didn't know what to expect, and I had heard all kinds of ominous things. And it's true, the city there on the other side is not as well-lit, not as jovial, not as lively as West Berlin, but it's an amazing city, too. It's big, it's scenic, and there's all kinds of things going on. And I think this the developments of this week, of the last couple of days, can only do good for both sides, because there are so many people. These people know each other, they're related, and they've been separated artificially. And I think any kind of a situation where you have a wall built to separate people is just not acceptable. And you know what's really good about this is the fact that all the years of the Cold War, from JFK to Johnson, to Nixon, to Reagan, all those years of the arms race didn't do a thing to get that wall gone. Not one thing. It only made things worse. You know what got that wall torn down? The people of East Germany. Not running away, staying there, and getting in the streets, demonstrating, signing petitions, demanding change. They're the ones that did it. They're the heroes of this. All the rhetoric of East versus West only made things worse. In the end, it's the people that make the change. And one thing I got to say, I think Bush is doing the right thing by laying low, by not spouting forth with too much rhetoric, and letting the East German people decide for themselves. And I think that's what has to be done, as in Poland, as in Hungary. Unless, of course, the West did buy Hungary. I'm not really certain about that. Our telephone number is 632-6901. I want to hear from people. People who have never been to Berlin. People who have been to Berlin. I want to know what their thoughts of this are. How is it going to change things here? Is it going to change things here? What are your impressions? Do you have any questions? Anything to wonder about? Because I asked a lot of questions when I was over there. I mean, I kept that guy up nights asking him questions about, you know, well, how do you do this if you want to go to the east? And, you know, how does the subway system work? And, you know, all kinds of bizarre things like that. It's a most amazing place. 632-6901, area code 516. Good evening.
Thank you for calling Dollar Seats. Can you please hold?
Sorry? You know, that person was on for about 45 minutes just to do that. That's pretty funny. 632-6901. Let's hope there's other people out there. Certainly would be nice. 300,000 East Germans have crossed the border. Most to visit as all the travel restrictions have eased and workers begin opening the holes in the wall. That was quite a sight to see cranes, to see bulldozers actually tearing down the wall. And, you know, you have to wonder, is it propaganda on the part of East Germany? Probably. It probably is propaganda. It probably has, you know, quite a bit to do with their public image. But so what? Who cares? It's a great thing to see nonetheless. 632-6901. Good evening. Hello? Are there any people out there? Because I can just play music if nobody's out there. I mean, you know, this is kind of silly. Let's see what's going on historically as far as this whole Berlin escapade. Bear with me for a moment while I haven't even seen these papers yet, and I'm trying to find out what's pertinent. Okay, by the simple act of forcing their communist rulers to open the Berlin Wall and allow them to go wherever they wish, the people of East Germany have irrevocably changed the way Berlin, Germany, and all of Europe have defined themselves for more than 40 years. It's incredible. Thousands and thousands of East Berliners celebrated their triumph today by promenading up and down the elegant tree-lined shopping boulevards of the western part of the city. That's known as the Kudamm, or if you want to say the whole thing, it's Kurfürstendamm. It's a big, huge parking shopping street with all kinds of shops, and it's just huge. It goes on forever. I walked down it one day, and it took about an hour and a half to walk all the way down it, and it's just so incredible. You know, you get the feeling of space anywhere in Berlin, East or West Berlin. Just so much you can hold your arms out. Of course, I don't think you can do that now because there's so many people there, but it's just so incredibly big and fun. It's a fun city. If you ever want to go to a fun place, go there. All right, let's try another couple more calls. 632-6901. Good evening. Huh? Good evening.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say I think it's good.
Yeah? Have you been following the situation?
Yes.
And, I don't know if it's coming across either tonight or through the news, but this is a, you know, one of the most historic things that has ever happened. You know, I don't actually know where it's going to go from here. You know, the East versus West mentality is completely breaking down. You know.
Yeah.
Any questions or thoughts from you?
I say that. It makes me happy.
Uh-huh. Have you ever been to Europe?
No.
Do you ever plan on going?
Well, I'm only 15.
Uh-huh.
So, not in the near future.
Okay, well, there's lots of 15-year-olds over there, so, you know, you should check it out sometime. It's not expensive, you know. A lot of people think it's expensive to travel there, and it's you know, it costs a little bit, but not that much. And once you're there, it actually costs less to live than it does here, which kind of surprised me. So, you know, don't hold off too long because there's a lot of fun places to see and you might become hooked.
But, you know how he was saying a West over East victory?
Yeah.
I think that it is definitely one. Because, I mean, it's just like in Russia how it's becoming more democratic, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I don't see how you can say that it's not.
Well, I could see how you might be able to because it's not West winning over East. It's Western values winning, but it's the people. You know, the people in the East are the ones that are making the changes. You know, they're the ones that are enforcing it.
Democracy is more the natural way of life, making your own decisions and having a say in things.
Well, you know, I would agree that that seems to be the best way, but, you know, there's lots of countries that don't think that's the best way. It's good to see people change. No matter, you know, the communist revolutions were inspiring too. I mean, the 1917 revolution in Russia was an inspiration to many, many other countries, obviously. In the same way, this is an inspiration because this is a revolution of another sort. Any revolution inspires other countries, other people. And it's good to see it going the way that we here in the West like it to go. But, you know, the question is what's going to happen in the future? I don't know. It's going to be interesting, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
Well, what else are you going to be talking about tonight?
What else do you want to talk about?
I don't know.
Okay, well, when you think of something, let me know.
Okay.
Fair enough?
Uh-huh.
Okay, 632-6901. Good evening. Hello? There's a lot of intelligent people out there tonight. Look, let's fill up the phone line so I don't have to deal with these morons anymore and see if anybody out there has any thoughts. 632-6901. Where was I? I was looking at an article here. Yes, Willy Brandt. Do you know who Willy Brandt was? I do. He was the mayor of West Berlin when the wall was built in 1961. And he said at a rally yesterday evening, "The moving together of the German states is taking shape in reality in a different way than many of us expected." And that's interesting, too. You know, that's something that I can't help but wonder about. You know, what if they do reunite the two Germanys? That's going to make a really big country. I mean, East Germany is the most prosperous country in the communist bloc. You might think the Soviet Union is the biggest. No, they're not. I mean, they're the biggest, yes, but they're not the most prosperous. East Germany has always been at the forefront of their technological age, as it is. And if you merge the two countries together, you're going to have almost a superpower. How does that make people feel? Especially after the things that have happened in Germany this century. Okay, we have two calls. Let's get three more, and I'll go back to the phone, 632-6901. I've heard a lot of people express reservations about that. So I'd like to know if you think it's inevitable that they reunite. And if it's not, how do you have two countries that have democratic ways existing side by side when they're the same, you know, be dividing the United States in half and having one half no real different than the other half, you know? Would that work? Actually, it's not a bad idea, is it? 632-6901. Changes going on all over the East. Poland, on April 17th, communist government grants the Solidarity Trade Union legal status and allows limited opposition participation in elections. Solidarity wins virtually every seat it is allowed to seek, then puts together a legislative majority. We're up to three calls. We only need two more. In August, oh boy, this was a trick. This was a trick, wasn't it? I hate saying this guy's name. I got to try it again. Okay, in August, Tadeusz, okay, halfway through, Mazowiecki. You gotta admire the Poles. You gotta admire them, because it's like they make this challenge in everyday speech, you know. And once you can do that, once you can say these names, you know, you can do a lot. Boy, one more call is what we need. 632-6901. Okay, anyway, in August, that guy became the first non-communist prime minister of a Soviet bloc nation. This is all this year. In Czechoslovakia, police attacked demonstrators in January. They launched a similar assault on demonstrators in August during a rally marking the Soviet-led invasion of 1968. So not much in the way of changes going on in Czechoslovakia government-wise, but, of course, people-wise, there is. Soviet Union, of course, Mikhail Gorbachev, who fathered the reforms sweeping the Eastern Bloc, deals with ethnic disputes and labor unrest spurred by his tolerance of dissent. And scores of communists are voted out in the Soviet Union's first competitive elections. I'm going to go to the phones in just a moment. Let me just tear through these countries really quickly. Romania, President Nicolae, you know, I remember how to say that name. It's nothing like the way you spell it. Ceaușescu, I think, is how you say it. I don't know. But anyway, he ruled so harshly that any opposition is crushed at the outset. And Romania remains the most repressive of the Warsaw Pact nations. And in case you're wondering about Albania, well, Albania is not a Warsaw Pact nation. They hate the communist world. I mean, they're a communist nation, but they hate the Eastern Bloc. It's really weird. It's fascinating, too. Bulgaria. Todor Zhukov resigned. That just happened yesterday, indicating that the nation he has led for 34 years may begin to embrace change more readily. Last week, about 9,000 people gathered in the capital, which is Sofia, in the first known pro-democracy rally in the country's communist history. And, of course, we've been through East Germany, and finally, Hungary. In February, the Communist Party endorses democratic elections. In May, Hungary begins removing border fortifications with Austria to symbolize its quest for close ties with the West. And, of course, that started all this East German stuff, people running across the border of Hungary to get to Austria, and from there, West Germany and the West and all that. And on October 7th, Hungary's Communist Party reconstitutes itself as the Hungarian Socialist Party. Amazing, you know. It almost makes me jealous because so much is going on over there and so little seems to be going on over here. Maybe I'm wrong. If I am, please tell me. 632-6901. Good evening. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, your last thought is kind of how I called in.
Okay.
I don't own a TV, so I'm not really up on it. But your comment about how they petitioned the people petitioned their government to the point where this whole thing started happening for them. The governments in Europe, they seem to work more with the people, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, even we're talking about what East Berlin here and stuff, you know.
Right.
And I had a morning class this morning, you know, and I spoke with a young lady, and people in the States, Americans, they have really no relation to the government. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of like a distant thing, like a celebrity status. And, you know, in East Berlin, Egon Krenz, the new leader of East Germany, was speaking and being booed by people. And it's, I can imagine Bush doing that. I can imagine him being booed, but I can't imagine him speaking to real people, you know?
Well, I was kind of, like, getting involved with the idea that, like, nothing really changes, you know. The trend nowadays is that it seems that people are so tired nowadays, you know, that they really don't, especially young people, you know.
What, people here are tired?
Yeah, and the 2 years I spent in Europe, the Germany also, that the German government tends to look out, I think education is why I called, you know, because in this country here, it seems that education is really starting to, we're almost building, you know, a wall about educating young people here, you know.
You mean we're neglecting education?
Financially, it's becoming more and more exclusive, you know.
But why do you think that is? I mean, it seems like such a self-destructive thing to do, to cut funding to education of all things.
Yeah, I think that really it's like cancer or something, but the outcome of it really is not going to be a positive thing, you know. All the young people, I'm 35, by the way, and all of the young people that I know that go to school are just like, just totally exhausted, you know. And those are just the people that are making the effort. It seems to me that, like, a lot of people coming up are just becoming, just going to the working class, you know?
Uh-huh.
And this thing about tearing down the wall and stuff, they seem like they're making some progress. And here in the States, I wonder really, I really wonder what the hell is going on. What direction, where's the growth in this country going to be, you know what I mean? It's the big news is that they're tearing the wall down. But what about the news here?
Well, what do we focus on? You know, you need something to focus on.
That's the whole thing, though. See, that's the whole thing. It's just the constant attitude of what do we focus on, and it keeps getting. It seems to be like a real financial kind of snare these days, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's great they're tearing the wall down, you know. I love to see that kind of thing.
It's inspirational, you know, because you can apply that kind of...
Not here, though, you know? This is why I called. I mean...
It's. I'm sorry, what did you just say?
I'm saying, what about here, you know, down the block, you know?
Well, you know, it's inspirational to us in an individual kind of a way, you see, because governments act a lot like people. Governments are defensive sometimes, and they have false pride, and you see a lot of that in Eastern Bloc countries, and you see a lot of that with people, too. Now, maybe we can tear down some of our own walls, you know? It sounds kind of sappy, I know, but... We do the same thing. You know, the wall is a symbol of oppression, and people can be oppressive on an individual basis. And maybe it's time that stopped, and people were becoming more open with each other. I see it happening to a degree.
I see it happening, but I can't help but feel that the you know, something major's got to happen before any real change comes, you know, like the depressions and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's kind of sad, but I see it going that way, you know.
Well, we had one gentleman a few weeks ago predicting that the stock market was going to disintegrate. We have another person who calls up that says the whole world's just going to go environmentally to hell. So we do have things to focus on, economic, environmental, social. Maybe we have too many things to focus on.
I think the whole thing, I think I would like to see, like, some of the walls torn down about the, like, I'd like to see the government, a lot of changes made to where the government views the individual, you know, as far as like, educating people in an educational sense, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, really just tearing down the walls about this financial burden that's placed upon an education, you know? And, you know, and the whole dollar sign that goes through the education and on the other side of the whole thing like that, like education and medicine, I'd really, you know, you're talking about changes in Europe about this wall coming down. The changes I'd like to see in this country, really, and they're going to be slow, if any, is... the government, the American government, to get more involved with the individual person in this country as far as like medical and educational kinds of benefits, where in countries like Germany, their governments are very much a part of the individual with their education and medical kinds of things.
Yes, but I'd like it to stop there. I want it to stop getting involved in say, moralistic things with the individual. You know, I'll take care of the individual. I think education should be free all the way through college. I mean, why not? It should be.
That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah, and nobody should have to starve to death in this country, and nobody should have to be hungry.
I mean, you know, like the change I like to see is to take the price off of education.
Yeah,
you know?
Education should not be treated as a commodity.
And you know, we'd probably never see it, but it'd be nice to take the price off of medical care too, you know?
Of course. And we have the right to live, you know, and we should not have to have that based upon how much money we make.
Oh, it's still the best place going, you know, I think.
It is, but that could also be a curse.
Walls I'd like to see come down, though. I really would like to see the price come off of education. And I mean, you know, and then we could really start to get to know what we're about, you know. And I mean, it's just the attitudes are so crazy. I met a woman from China in this country 7 months just before the Tiananmen Square thing, you know.
Yeah.
And They value education. Now, I'm not saying in a monetary sense, even though that they're very much aware that that's part of it, but their whole attitude about that they value education, you know? The idea in the States seems to be, I mean, it's just kind of sickening that the idea seems to be about money, you know?
Well,
there's such a connection between education and money, and...
I'll be honest about something though. When I went to school, high school, college, this stuff didn't really interest me all that much, and the teachers who tried to get it across didn't succeed. Maybe I just wasn't very receptive, but the whole thing struck me as you know, how does it affect me? It doesn't affect me. I'm just interested in my own things. Maybe that's a phase we all go through or something like that. But over the last few years, I have started reading newspapers a lot, looking into this whole mess of the world that we're in.
Yeah.
And it just gets more and more fascinating with everything that you look at and you want to know more. And when you don't have the pressure of a teacher standing over you, you know, telling you that the exam is next Friday, it suddenly becomes more something that you're interested in, you know?
I don't feel the pressure from the teachers or my fellow students, but more from the economy, you know, is where I feel the pressure from.
Uh-huh. Well, do you think it's something that that is fightable, that you have any chance against?
I really don't think so, to tell you the truth. You know, it's just a change I'd like to see. You know, I think a lot of people would. Just take the price tag off education and bring the wall down, you know?
Yeah, well, I think if you keep voicing your opinion, at least a couple more people will hear it and might start agreeing with you, you know?
Even the company I work for, you know, used to be real big on assisting employees in their education. And I spoke with their educational people back a year and a half ago, you know, and the attitude was really that we really can't do much for you. We used to do this, but we can't, you know. And I'm thinking, where are these trends? You know, these trends are coming out of where are they coming from? You know, who's?
Yeah, well, eventually it's going to end up doing something.
You know, and I'll get off the line. I know there's more people calling in.
Okay.
More pertinent stuff. But, I mean, when you stop to think that a credit or three credits is worth $300, you know, it's really, to me, that's kind of sad.
It is, or that, you know, an operation is $10,000 or something crazy like that.
I really don't think it does anything to make our country strong.
No, and it...
You know, it doesn't create any unity for the people, and it's just a sad situation. I really like to see it change. I don't know, really, if maybe in a few years I might be able to affect some kind of change with that. I would love to be able to. At this point, I'm not, you know.
Well, I think the only thing I can suggest is just don't be quiet, you know, because that's the only way you can be sure not to make any change is if you don't talk about it.
Okay, I'll open line up, but, you know, I'm all for the walls coming down.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Have a good night.
All right. 632-6901. Good evening.
Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I was interested in commenting on the question that was raised, is the wall coming down a triumph for the West?
Okay.
I know that the leaders of our country would like to make it seem that way, but it seems to me that the kind of society that Solidarity wants, that people in Eastern Europe want, that probably people in the Soviet Union want, is more that of the social democracies in Europe. In Sweden, in Finland, in Spain, in France, in many of the states of West Germany, which are run by social democrats, or West Germany is from time to time, that's what really attracts people, is an advanced welfare state. And seems to me we are seeing a failure of communism. We used to say, well, there's going to be the struggle in the world is between capitalism and communism. I think now it will be between capitalism and social democracy.
That sounds a bit more palatable.
People in the Western Soviet Union get television from Finland. People in Poland get television from Sweden. People in East Germany get television from West Germany. And just as your friend in Berlin said, well, the radio waves go across borders. That's true of television as well. But it seems to me it's a triumph for the West insofar as we are democratic, but I don't think they want a U.S. deal or a Nexon or something like that in their country. I think they want a sort of mixed economy that exists in Sweden.
I think that's really what any country would want. Do you think that this is something that that we can credit the people of East Germany with accomplishing without any help from the West?
Well, obviously, somebody was the brave guy that went out and started the first demonstration, that spoke out, that organized, that set up an opposition. So we're certainly getting closer to world citizenship, or at least a Western citizenship. The chap from Berlin said he could tell an East Berliner from a West Berliner, perhaps. But as you look at the crowds over there, East Berlin or West Berlin, they look like they could be in New York City or La Crosse, Wisconsin, or Miami, Florida.
And you know, you notice the same thing when you look at a crowd in Moscow.
Yeah. They have on jeans, they have on sneakers, they have on an athletic jacket, so that national barriers and national peculiarities seem to be diminishing. But I think the really attractive force has been countries like West Germany or Sweden, where housing is guaranteed, where child care is guaranteed, where medical care is guaranteed, where education is guaranteed. And you can do that without enormous state enterprises.
So why do you think it is that we can't?
In this country?
Yes.
Well, in a way, we and the Russians are both victims of the Cold War. They poured so much of their research and development and engineering and science and capital into the arms race that eventually their economy was about to break down. But to a considerable extent, we've done the same thing. I mean, we have an enormous military machine, and we're outproduced by the Japanese, who don't have that expense. We spend our money, research and development, on a stealth bomber. They spend theirs on Toyotas. So we buy Toyotas, and they buy Rockefeller Center. And we wonder what's wrong until you look out the window of Rockefeller Center and see all the Toyotas.
Uh-huh.
So that if we could be freed from this terrible drain over and over again, if you say to the federal government, the answer to homelessness is housing, the answer to problems in inner city are Head Start and child care and housing and things like that, they say, gosh, we'd like to do that, but we can't afford it because we're reconditioning battleships from World War II.
This is starting to hit me for the first time, but really for the last 40 or so years, this country has been at war, hasn't it?
More or less.
That's incredible. Now, do you think that that these events, all these events that are happening in Eastern Europe and the overall mood in Western Europe, do you think that will maybe get us out of this finally, out of this Cold War mentality?
Well, it's obviously going to take a while. You know, you would think if it was announced, Grumman is going to close and it's going to stop building weapons of death and pouring millions of dollars to get 16 planes a year, people would go out and dance in the streets. And they're not.
Well, and the reason for that, though, is that people would be out of jobs. Now, would there be a way to make up those jobs if we were able to apply it someplace else, perhaps?
Well, we certainly need lots of things. We need our interstate highway systems falling apart, our whole infrastructure, the sewers, the water mains in New York City are old and need to be replaced. We have terrible pollution problems. We don't know what to do with our garbage. There are lots of useful things could be done. We might even start making better cars again, that sort of thing. But you need some government leadership in reconversion. When World War Two ended, we reconverted tank factories to making trucks. Without an economy that is based on the military-industrial complex.
So do you think that we're heading in that direction at least? I just want to know if I should feel optimistic about this.
I think we have to head in that direction. I don't see how we can go any other way. I think this is going to mean a serious decline in Republican Party dominance in the country. The two issues that the Republican Party has used to maintain control through the Reagan years and now the Bush years have been choice issues, pro-choice, anti-choice, anti-abortion issues, and we can defend the country better. We're better on national defense. We're harder on communism. And all of a sudden, the tide has turned in terms of pro-choice issues, and your friend in West Berlin said, Cold War is over. Cold War is over, you know? For years and years, people like Gene Kirkpatrick said, no communist government will ever be voted out of office peacefully. Just happened in Poland. For years, people said, no communist party will ever go out of existence. Just happened in Hungary. For years, people said, well, why is there a Berlin Wall? You know, the Berlin Wall shows that we can't let down our guard. Now the people put up the wall are knocking down the wall. So what should reasonable, thoughtful people do? They should cut back on defense spending and a Cold War mentality and give some of the money we need in this country, and some of it could be sent to Poland, which badly needs it. For years, we've spent billions on fighting communism in countries like Poland, and now that they're willing to give it up, we spend about 100 times as much in El Salvador as we do in Poland. So if we're people ruled by reason, as Jefferson always argued people were, we'll make those changes.
Let me ask you one more question, then I'll go on to some more calls. How does the prospect of a reunified Germany strike you?
See, if you say a reunified Germany is very scary, that's certainly true. You know, people, I fought in World War II. I remember being very hostile towards Germany at that time. But if West Germany is part of a united Europe or a united Western Europe, then it's not so scary. What people don't realize is that Europe is already so, Western Europe is already so homogenized that somebody from East Germany goes to West Germany can go to Holland and get a job, then go to France to get a job, go to Portugal and get a job, then go to Spain to get a job. So that if a united Germany is part of a united Europe, doesn't seem so scary, does it?
Not really, no.
Yeah, all righty.
Thanks very much for calling, sir.
Bye.
632-6901 is our telephone number, area code 516. Good evening.
I'm back.
You're back?
Yep.
Who are you?
I called before.
Oh, okay. What do you have to say?
Well, I was just wondering, Europe's supposed to have a unified monetary system soon, aren't they?
Well, I know that was being discussed, and I know Margaret Thatcher was very much against it, and I don't know for sure if that's really going to happen. If there'll be just one form of currency for, say, West Germany and France and Holland. I somehow can't see that, because that's really making a major change. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah. I mean, they're so close. It's kind of like the colonies in the United States during before the Revolution. They all different money, and you really can't go different places without spending a lot of time converting it and stuff.
They are very close. I mean, you know, it's possible to go cross country in most of those places, you know, in only a couple of hours,
yeah,
you know, by car. And When I went across Europe this summer, I spent so much time changing money, and I don't know if I got ripped off. I very well might have, because, you know, how do I know how many, you know, Deutschmarks are equal to pounds and things like that? It's just, you know, after a while, you just say, okay, whatever, just give me, you know, whatever you think I'm supposed to get.
It's a lot easier for them, too. I mean, I'm sure they have the same problem going through different countries.
I imagine they do. Right now, though, it's there really aren't borders in the true sense. I mean, you can get from country to country in Western Europe without even having to show your passport many times. You know, I think the one exception to that is England, because, you know, they're an island.
Yeah.
But to get from, say, Holland to Belgium, or from Belgium to Germany, no problem. You know, no guards at the border or anything like that. And sure, it would be nice if all of Europe was like that. It would be nice if the whole world was like that. You know, why do we really need borders? Because we're scared of invading armies and things like that, I guess. And if that fear is gone, then we're really free, you know. That's what we're aiming for.
Well, there are always going to be problems. I mean, even with a unified world, somebody would still, there would still be racism and stuff like that.
Oh, sure, you know, and a unified world presents its own problems, because then you have all kinds of things unified that are unhealthy to unify, you know.
In charge. An argument starts over that already.
Who's in charge? Yes, certainly.
I mean, it's also these people talking about education, you know?
Yeah.
It's in the United States, it's expensive because the teachers are expensive. You're hiring people who have undergone extensive education themselves, and they require or they ask for a higher pay. So then the college has to jack up their price.
Yeah, but I know, and I think many people know, the teachers in the United States really don't get paid all that much. It'd be an interesting comparison to see how much it costs to train a soldier and how much it costs to train a teacher. I wonder which costs more. You know, if anyone can figure that out, I'd like to know. You know, because I think that's what it's really boiling down to. You know, which do we need more, teachers or soldiers? If you have more soldiers, you have to take out that many teachers. You know, because there's only so much money to go around. What are our priorities? And in a way, the military is a school in itself. You know, it's just really, what school are we going to place our value on? Are we going to be a military-based society or an education-based society? And I think we've been a military-based society for too long. And it's time to change as things are changing in Eastern Europe. You know, it's time for us to change as well. We can't just stay the way we are.
A lot of American kids, I mean, in my school, they're stupid. I mean, I don't know what this world's going to be like in 30 years.
Do you think they're stupid?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, do you think they're stupid because that's all they can possibly do, or are they stupid perhaps by choice?
Yeah, but it doesn't make, if they don't start now, at least learning something, they're going to be wasted.
Well, you know, it's all peer pressure. It's all what your friends are doing. And you know what's interesting? You know, much as I'm an anti-military type person, I do notice this. When people that I think are stupid go into the military, when they come out, they seem to have a lot of things together. They seem to be able to talk a bit more rationally. And even though I don't like what they're saying, they do say it well. And that means that...
I don't want everybody... Everybody doesn't go into the military, and you can't force everybody to go into
of course not.
Learn manners or morals or whatever.
But it just, it proves that it is possible to get through to people and to make them change a bit and learn.
Yeah.
Now,
but
the military, I don't think, is the right environment to do that at all. But if the schools could somehow reach people a bit more, and that's not just the school's problem, obviously that's society's problem as well, then we could solve some of these issues.
And a lot of kids don't read anymore either.
I've noticed that. I tell people when I see them from other countries that reading is no longer required in this country. It's an option. And I'm beginning to wonder how much of a joke that really is, because, you know, a lot of people do not read things anymore. I mean,
I love to read. I mean, reading to me is so much better than TV.
It is. No, you're certainly right there, because there's just so much you can do. First of all, you can read anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need electricity to read. And you're linking minds with people from hundreds, maybe even thousands of years ago. You know, you're linking minds with it. It's just so amazing that you can read their words and sort of enter their brain and hear their thoughts. It's as intimate as you can possibly get with somebody. And, you know, a lot of people are missing out on that. And the thing is, there are so many books so readily available. And, yeah, you know, it's tough to get started, I guess, especially if it's not a popular thing to do. And especially with all the distractions in our society. But it's well worth it. I mean, what fun is life if you don't take a few risks?
And there are so many books. I mean, any subject you can think of, you've got to enjoy. There's at least one book out on something that you enjoy.
Sure, and what we're talking about here tonight, Eastern Europe, the Berlin Wall in itself, I'll bet there's thousands of books about that, you know. And if you are interested, if you say, hey, you know, this is kind of interesting, I'd like to learn more about it, just go to the library, look up Berlin Wall, and, you know, you'll be an expert on the subject in a couple of hours. It's that easy.
It's also, like you said, I don't like to have to read things when teachers hang them over my head. I enjoy reading when I pick up a book and I tell myself to read it.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. You know, I never really enjoyed learning until I was out of school. And that's got to mean something, you know. Some of it must be a phase I was going through, but I think a lot of it has to do with just the unpleasant environment of school. And let's face it, most kids don't like school because it's not pleasant. Having to do certain things, you know, people don't like being told what to do. And, you know, you should want to do these things. So I think school should more inspire you rather than dictate to you.
That's why, like, tests and homework, they really can't judge your intelligence. Because in a lot of the tests, like social studies and stuff, the answers, you can kind of, on some of this year, I have a class with the questions are more what were the people thinking and what were the reasons behind this.
Uh-huh.
And you can get any answer they have, a lot of the answers they have, you can kind of explain it. Your choice. If I choose one and they tell me it's wrong, I can almost explain it. And my answer is almost correct. I mean, I can back up my answer, and yet they're telling me it's wrong.
And that's so unhealthy, to have a certain format that you cannot deviate from in any way. I mean, yeah, there are lots of instances where, you know, the teacher is wrong and the student is correct, or the test is wrong, and, you know, the student can prove that, you know, his answer is correct. And, you know, that should be encouraged. That kind of individual thinking is what keeps us going.
It's like in English.
Mm-hmm.
All the writers you see glorified today have their own styles. But if they were in English class now, they would get F's.
That's true.
E. Cummings, how he writes in all small letters.
Uh-huh.
No English teacher would give him an A on a poem.
That's true.
And so if somebody has an original style and they're getting F's, they're discouraging originality.
And, you know, it's true of anything else, too. The way you dress, the way you comb your hair, you know, people should be as outlandish and different as they want to be. And that should be, you know, encouraged. It should be, well, you know, if not encouraged, it shouldn't be discouraged.
Yeah.
Both by, you know, the teachers and your friends and your parents. Because, you know, what's wrong with wanting to look different, wanting to be different? I think that's great. That's, you know, we should all be trying to be something different, because, you know, we're going to hit on something eventually. We're going to hit on who we really are by experimenting.
Yep.
If you just, you know, follow the instructions, you're not going to have any fun. You know, and you're also going to be a pretty boring person.
Exactly.
Well, I'd like to hear from some teachers, you know. If there's any teachers out there listening, I'd like to know what they think of the whole educational system, you know, and if it's as bad as we seem to think it is.
That would be interesting to hear.
Yeah, because, I mean, they must have some insight on all this, you know, how kids don't respond and whether school is an oppressive kind of institution or what.
Well, some teachers care. I mean, some teachers care.
Oh, yeah.
Some don't. And you really have to find out which ones are which.
And a lot of teachers look upon, not a lot, but some teachers look upon teaching as a job. And as in any job, eventually you begin to hate the you know, the people you come in contact with, like a, you know, a store manager begins to hate customers because they're all so stupid and they ask stupid questions. Now imagine a teacher having the same attitude towards students. That's you know, a customer can go to another store. What's a student going to do?
And another thing I find is a lot of teachers in my school, at least, I'm not going to say other schools, but they seem to lack interest in what they're teaching. They're reading or teaching directly from the book. They just, like, translate it, write it on the board, and that's all.
Uh-huh.
I think that maybe they should put a little originality and explain it better than the book, or else they might as well just hand us books at the beginning of the year and sit back and not teach at all.
Did you see Dead Poets Society?
No.
Oh, you have to see that. You have to see that. I'll tell you one scene where Robin Williams, as the new professor, begins teaching the students about poetry, and they open up the textbook, and the textbook proceeds in the introduction to explain what is poetry and what is good poetry and what is bad poetry, you know, and the rules and things like that. And Robin Williams just says, I want everybody to rip that page out, and we're going to find out for ourselves what's good and what's not.
Yeah.
And that was so amazing, because that's what it's all about. I wish I had a teacher like that, you know?
Yeah.
But I know they're out there. I know there's teachers like that out there.
Yeah, sure, but they're so few that really care and have the dedication like that.
Yeah. I'd like to hear more about them. Anyway, thanks very much for calling. I think we've opened up some very good topics here.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye.
632-6901. Good evening. Interesting. That sounded like Fisher's Island, actually. I know Fisher's Island busy signals when I hear them. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, let me turn the radio down.
Okay.
Hi.
How you doing?
I found that kid was pretty interesting.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he?
Well, because I was going to say so pretty much the same thing.
Yeah?
Like, kids these days, and even when I was younger, you know, they just don't care about about anything at all,
sir,
most of them.
Sir, I just have a problem with any phrase that begins with kids these days, you know what I mean?
Let me put it like this. You know, it's true. Kids in general generally have very little interest in anything outside, you know, their world, their little world.
But were you any different?
Yes, I was, because I read a lot. It was a habit I had ever since I was a little kid, and I was always, you know, I always wanted to learn more about the things that interested me.
And how did you develop that habit?
I was brought up that way, I guess. Both my parents are big readers, and they got me to read at an early age.
I see.
You know, they taught me before I went to school, you know, to read. You know, they would always read to me and show me, you know, the ABC and whatnot. And so, you know, before I was in kindergarten, you know, I knew the rudiments of reading before I started to be taught in the school. And I think, like you said, that has a lot to do with it, because I always liked to read. I always read what I enjoyed. And when I was in school, a lot of the things that I was taught, you know, bored me to tears.
And that's true. I don't think anyone can say that that hasn't happened to them.
You know, but I think a lot of it has to do with, to tell you the truth, with television. I think over the past 15 years or so, television has really gone downhill. And I don't think, to tell you the truth, you know, I don't think that children should be allowed to watch a lot of the things that are on commercial TV these days.
Right, I agree with what you're saying, except for the fact
that MTV, for instance, is that you cannot let a 6-7-year-old child, I mean, watch MTV. They have simulated sex on it all day long. It's what it is.
But, I mean, do you think the 6- or 7-year-old understands what that is in the first place?
I think that after being exposed to it, you know, children being smart as they are, they'll pick it up.
Uh-huh.
You know, I really think that that has a lot to do with it. It's on, you know, all the time.
I mean, isn't MTV just another avenue of society? Isn't MTV just another avenue of society? I mean, isn't it something that these kids could hear in the street anyway?
Yeah, it's a reflection of, you know, the general narcissistic and vapid culture of these days.
Okay, it's a reflection, so
Indeed, but that goes to show, you know, if this is what culture is becoming, then we're in sad shape.
Well, then that's the issue to be addressed, you know, I think
about it. This is art, you know, I mean, this is great music, I mean, what has been produced in the past, I don't know how many years, it could really be called a masterpiece.
Right, but if your kid wants to watch it, you have to ask yourself why, you know, and not say, you can't watch this. You know, just, if you make arbitrary rules, how are you any different than East Germany saying you can't do this?
I'm not making arbitrary rules saying it should be banned.
Right.
You know, if you want to watch it, that's your right. Hey, you can watch what you want. And a lot of people, you know, like what they want, and that doesn't, you know, mean anything bad. But, you know, there's just a lot of these things really, you know, I don't know how to put it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of these things children shouldn't be watching. That's one thing.
Uh-huh.
I feel that. I mean, it's like you could say everybody has to be free to express themselves. But think about it. Isn't there limits to what you can call to be expression and what just becomes like a form of, graffiti?
Yeah, I suppose, but, you know,
it's just like shocking people, like with the art world. Who can say what art is?
Exactly, and
a definition of what art is, and what does art become? In a lot of circles, art seems to be something that offends everyone's sensibilities. And it's just so, and it has no justification for being art. Now, that doesn't mean, I'm not saying that it should be banned, but I'm saying, you know, like you said, art is a reflection of the society that creates it. And I think a lot of what's being created today is garbage.
But, you know, I think it's a lot more of a threat if you have things that happen this week, you know, where the government actually stops funding because they don't approve of... I mean, there was this one exhibit in New York that is not being funded because it was looked upon as being too political. Now, how can you say, you know, something can't be art if it's political? I mean, politics is the basis of art. It has been for all time. You know, and now you have a government saying, well, we're not going to fund this if you don't like what it's saying.
I think I disagree with that much of art has been not politically motivated, but dedicated to the portrayal of what is beautiful.
Well, I mean, yeah, but a lot of art has political roots to it. I mean,
especially recently, at any rate. But I'm not saying we ban anything. I'm not saying we, you know, outlaw anything, or, you know, but I'm saying that we need to take a hard look at ourselves and see what's going on in our own country. I mean, what's going on in Eastern Europe is great, but I think it's time we take a good hard look right here and see what's going wrong with America. And there's a lot of things going wrong with America, when you think about it, that need, you know, decisive leadership to be taken care of. And I don't see it coming from the presidency right now.
So what would you have him do?
Think about it. I think if the other candidate was elected, it really wouldn't have changed that much. You still wouldn't have seen any truly decisive leadership. Like, look, we have all these things going on in Eastern Europe. And what has Bush done? He hasn't done it. He hasn't said anything. Maybe he's afraid of, I don't know, upsetting the Russians or something, but he still hasn't taken any steps yet. And he's been president for how long? And what really has he done? He's done nothing that I can see.
Well, what step do you want him to take?
A lot of steps, really. He should start to do a lot of things and create a lot of new approaches to some problems that really have to be taken care of here.
Well, can you just be a little bit more specific?
Well, for instance, there's millions of people in this country who are born in poverty.
Okay.
And I think that's a disgrace. In the richest country in the world, millions of people are born into hopeless situations. So, you know, it's like, we need some kind of, like, something new. Welfare doesn't work as it is. It's a total waste of money as it is. Something has to be done so that, you know, this country finally becomes, you know, as good as it really could be. So, you know, there's a lot of things that should be done. You know, there's a lot of problems in the world, and he's not really doing anything about it.
Interesting point, though.
No, I mean, it's like I said, in East Germany, what has he said about all this going on in East Germany? Is he, you know, why doesn't, you know, he should take some dramatic act, do something, you know, say, all right, we'll come up with this money instead of producing these ridiculous stealth bombers that it can be seen now, I think. You know, he could have done those, you know, it cost $500 million a plane. The plane is worth more than its weight in gold. That's a fact. The price is right now. And, you know, and for what? For 50 planes. It's ridiculous. That money could have went to something that would be not just a waste and something that will be obsolete in 10 years. It could have been an investment that would grow. These are the kinds of things they have to look at. because, you know, it's hard to say. Like the guy was saying before, with socialism and capitalism, it's starting to come to a point where that big businesses like Grumman and all, in a way, they function almost as like, you know, they produce planes, but they're paid by the government. So in a way, they're like an extension of like the government welfare system, in a sense that like Grumman is like pork barrel from Washington that keeps all these jobs here going. And without that, you know, a lot of people are going to be out of work, and it's going to be a terrible thing.
Unless something is created,
it comes up that they can still make and keep their job that will be profitable.
Right, and it doesn't have to be military in nature.
That's another thing we're looking at. A company like Grumman, they're going under because of one product. You know, if the F-14s were killed, Grumman, you know, it would have been their death knell, virtually. They would have been finished on Long Island at any rate. They would have pulled up. They're already getting them ready to pull up to go to, say, you know, Texas, I believe. But it's like that with all our companies. Look how, like, we're so outclassed by the Japanese. Because the way they work is their government is like a coalition between the large industrial interests and the government itself. And they both sit down to plan how the economy will be for the next 10 years. It's like they're only capitalist in the sense that they use the free market to sell their goods. But actually, Japan is the most highly and the most efficiently planned economy in the world. And they're succeeding. Look at all the money they have.
That's very true.
And look at all the money we've squandered since, you know, I don't know when
debt.
It started.
Yeah.
But this big military buildup, all that money came from Japan. It's like, if you look at 1979, the world owed us nearly $1 trillion. In 1989, we owe everybody $1 trillion. And a lot of that's to overseas banks. You know, a lot of it comes from right here, too, but...
Now, I'm a bit ignorant on all this. How did that happen? How did the turnaround come about? Is there one thing we can point to?
Actually, it started, Carter began it when the Russians invaded Afghanistan in 79. He really boosted the defense government, the defense budget, even before that, because there was like a big cutback after Vietnam. And then it's like all of a sudden we realized that, yes, the Soviets did have 70,000 tanks, and we only had 8. And then, you know, so they panicked. And instead of looking at the military situation realistically, they built all kinds of things that we really don't need. That, you know, it's not saying we should get rid of the military budget, especially at that time. But, you know, the way they spent that money was all wrong. And not only that, they spent so much of it, and they only got so much. Because now they're paying $500 million for a plane. And then the B-1 bomber, which is now obsolete, was like $250 million a plane. And now it's obsolete. It was never a very good plane. And not only that, bombers have been obsolete since since the rockets in the early 60s. You know, a bomber is like, you know, you could launch the rocket, it'll be in Moscow in half an hour, and you can't shoot it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've squandered so much money. When, you know, they always blow the Russian threat out of proportion. Threat, they are a great threat, but they, you know, every time the defense budget comes up, or the Pentagon issues a study that, you know, makes them into like a towering giant, which they really are, because still, we're the most powerful country in the world. It's just that we're stupid and that we squander our power.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, there's a lot of potential here, and I always say that.
Country in the world.
What, sorry?
It's the greatest country in the world.
Well, it could be a lot greater, I think.
It should be a lot greater. It's a shame that it isn't.
Well, that's not the final answer, you know.
It's not.
Something could still change.
I think we need some change.
I think we're getting some change. It's just a question of how do we react. Like you say, Bush should be doing more.
He should be doing a lot of things.
We as people should be doing more, too, because what's happening, you know, as we were saying before, this country has been at war for the last 40 years with the Eastern Bloc.
There
hasn't been a bloody war, but it has been a war nonetheless, and that war appears to have been ended on one side. Now, are we going to end it on our side?
I think we're going to.
Now, if we do, I think that will lead to a lot of the problems being solved that we're talking about today.
And again, it's interesting to, cite an interesting historical parallel here. Between the dissolution of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire and the condition of the Soviet Union right now is, that's a pretty big question. How will the Soviets react to this? Their whole empire seems to be crumbling before them. All the places they've conquered since, say, 1940 or so, you know, in the Baltic states and after World War II in Eastern Europe, they're all demanding that, you know, they want their freedom. The communists are you know, falling apart.
But I think the they may be just as happy to get rid of them, you know, because
that remains to be seen. Gorbachev has so much on his hands.
It's a big pain to have colonies, you know, especially if they start demanding things. And look at it another way, you know, the people you see on TV walking in the streets of Moscow, do they want to control the people walking around the streets of Sofia, Bulgaria? No, they don't. Only the military leaders would want that.
This
is the age of the individual people, you know, and I think they're going to take control of the policies.
Be surprised, though. There's a pretty big nationalist sentiment in Russia, too, you know, despite the communists, free of the communists. So it remains to be seen if they'll let, you know, the borders all roll back, especially with the, you know, like I said, with the Baltic republics and all. You know, it could provoke a reaction, you know. It's like, how far can this go before the conservative circles over there react? You know, it's not over yet. This whole thing isn't over yet. Something could still come out of this that, you know, might be completely unforeseen and might not be good at all.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
For example, look at the way China reacted when its students got in the street. They shot them down.
I can't see that happening here, but I do know what you're saying as far as things almost looking too good to be true.
It seems to have succeeded over there. Nobody's rioting in the streets anymore.
Well, they're not rioting, but they haven't killed them all, and I don't think they ever will.
No, they never will. What those people started won't end, but for the time being, you know, they still have the status quo in place.
That's true.
You know, it's like those people who are in power there, a lot of them aren't really that ready to just let it slip by that easily. Maybe they'll be smart and they'll realize, you know, they have to adapt, but, you know, people don't always think and act rationally.
They certainly don't. Well, sir, it's been fun talking to you. We're out of time now.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
All right. Good night.
It's almost midnight, and time for us to be moving on. Interesting discussions. Sorry we didn't get to everybody. Our phone number, what am I giving the phone number for? We're leaving. Well, if you want to make a request for the next show, 632-6901. If you want to write it down for next week when we'll be back talking about something else, feel free. Maybe we'll talk about something less serious. But, God, how can we talk about anything else this week? This is, you know, your kids will ask you about this. You better remember where you were. Right here at WUSB Stony Brook, voicing your opinion. Well, if you didn't do it this week, you can do it next week. My name is Eric Corley. The program is called Brain Damage, and we'll be back again. We'll see you. Bye.